Marion, if I could start with you, can you explain what your symptoms were?
Well, they were many and varied and mostly absolutely horrible. Absolutely horrible. Things that you can't really explain because you just suddenly can't do something because you can't remember how to do it or when you're supposed to do it. They're crazy things like that. And you think, oh, God, I'm losing my mind. I'm working too hard. I'm tired. And incidentally, tired is a big thing. And then suddenly things happen like, God, I'm hot. Oh, hot, hot, hot. I was 47, 48 when this happened. One of the biggest things is called a dry vagina. And that makes sex singularly unpleasant. Not that you've got the energy anyway, but I'm just telling you. And so all your joys are cut out in one fell swoop. Because I didn't have a uterus, I was able to just have Premarin, which is estrogen only. And can you believe it? In a week, I turned back into me.
Many of you who I've spoken to already, a lot of people said they didn't really know anything about menopause until the symptoms started coming. But Jacqueline, you weren't ignorant to these things because of your job as a community health nurse.
For me, it was hot flashes, it was anxiety, getting nervous, crying for no reason sometimes, very sensitive, loss of libido. At times, very touchy, forget sometimes things.
You described to me an itchiness too, which
and like ants crawling on my body and dry skin, insomnia, and very irregular moods. What I found is that women from diverse cultural background is a bit of a tabooed topic. We learn it as you will know it when you go through it. It's not about prevention. We are more reactive.
Right.
So it's very important, and I think it's not just CAL women, I think it's mainstream women as well.
Dr. Jane Elliott, as you hear Marion and Jacqueline saying these stories, how common are the symptoms they're talking about?
They're all very, very familiar and what lots of women would complain of. I mean, only about 20% of women don't have any symptoms of menopause. Mm. So everybody else, 80%, gets something, and that range of symptoms is, there's nothing I've heard that is not common. Apart from the Jacqueline talking about the ants crawling, that's a particular symptom that is very classic. It's called formication, not fornication. Formication is about ants, and it's a feeling like little ants are crawling under your skin. There's nothing to see. And if you don't know about it, you know, the woman is presenting with ants crawling under me. You know, she gets the runaround for a bit. And the only thing that will help that is giving back some of the estrogen that's causing it.
So, Jane, what's happening in a woman's body at that point that produces those symptoms?
Well, I think it's important, although there are different hormones talked about, just to be really basic, menopause is just about your ovaries running out of eggs, no more babies, and no more estrogen. So menopause is about the body running out of estrogen, and all of the symptoms come from lack of estrogen.
So can all of them be treated with estrogen?
Absolutely, you've got it. That's menopause basics, yes. It's lack of estrogen, so estrogen is what you give back.
What is it that determines how a woman experiences menopause? If it's as simple as that,
I know.
Why do we have it?
We don't know. So all of us, once we're past the age of menopause, every woman who isn't on hormones has no estrogen in their blood, and 20% of the women with the same level in their blood have no symptoms at all, and we hate them because they make it look easy. But so the next lady might have. They'll have the same zero level of estrogen, but they will have some symptoms, and the next lady will have the same zero level of estrogen. And we actually don't know. There is some genetic background to this, why some women express the lack of estrogen in one way or the other, and some women don't get any symptoms, and some women just get a drop in bone density and get osteoporosis. Mm. We still don't know why different women react differently to the drop in estrogen.
I've always heard menopause talked about, but didn't really know what perimenopause is. Can you explain the correlation?
Can I do my teacher thing?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I do this,
absolutely.
I do this for patients, and I think it's just helpful. It's not very difficult. So squiggly, the line I'm going to draw is about levels of estrogen. So that's all it is. So through your 20s to 50, you have a period each month and your estrogen goes up and down. It drops a bit before every period. So that's normal fluctuations in estrogen. I'm going to cross over here to menopause. There's a gap here. Menopause is where you finally have your last period. That's what menopause is. It's defined as your last period. And we know that, and then there's no estrogen. No estrogen forever. So people say, well, when am I through menopause? Well, none of us are ever through it because the estrogen doesn't come back. It stays zero for the rest of our lives. So that's menopause. We know it's the woman's last period when she hasn't had a period for 12 months. So it's not defined by doing blood tests. That's really important to know. Between normal and no estrogen is a line, and that's called perimenopause. And that's a 4 to 5 year process because menopause is just a single day in a woman's life, last period. 4 to 5 years leading up to that last period, what happens to the estrogen? Unfortunately, it doesn't just drop in a nice straight line like that because people come in and see me with blood tests that people have done and they say, oh, I'm halfway through or three quarters of the way through. The way our estrogen behaves in the 4 to 5 years before menopause is like this. And that's why it feels like that. So if your estrogen is doing that, there's several things. Your periods can be doing that, stop, start, gaps. You can also see now why there's no point in doing a hormone blood test to try and diagnose menopause. But you women at this point feel like they're going mad because one minute they've got hot flushes when the estrogen's low, the next minute they have a period and they feel normal. The next minute they've got a high estrogen for a very few days and you get sore breasts and then it's all gone again and you're down here and sweating at night. So once you understand that graph, and I'm going to put another graph at the end, that was puberty. So isn't that a wonderful life we have? So that explains why menopause can feel like that, I think.
So Jane, at that point where you start going into that crazy period...
The zigzag crazies.
And then you get to zero.
Yep.
Are you feeling or having symptoms at every point of that?
Different people differently. Perimenopause with the variable estrogen is usually worse for most women because our brains don't like the zigzag. Most women feel a bit better as they go into a flat line of no estrogen. But the average past that last period of symptoms, the average for most women, is 8 years. So if you add 8 years to 4 to 5 years, that's a decade of most women's lives where they can be getting symptoms. For some women, significant symptoms.
From the way you've described it, you actually only know you've reached the menopause in retrospect.
Yes, that is correct, yeah. So the way we diagnose it is that if you've... The average age for menopause, last period, is 45 to 55, average, anywhere along that line. So if we go back 5 years, anyone from 40 onwards could be having symptoms. And the way we diagnose it, again, is not doing hormone blood tests, is just talking to women, which is why we spend a lot of time doing this. And once the periods are irregular and you are having symptoms of menopause, hot flushes, night sweats, joint aches, all of that sort of thing, that's the way we diagnose perimenopause without doing blood tests.
For some women, though, menopause hits quickly. Genevieve, for you, it wasn't a gradual entry into menopause. It hit almost overnight. Can you explain what happened to you when you went to get surgery at the age of 43 for an ovarian cyst?
I wasn't even thinking menopause. I basically had this bet with my gynae because I had ovarian cysts. If the cyst wasn't above 30
millimeters,
I made the decision. If it was above that, she made the decision. And that ding-dong for like a year or so, and then one day she just said, it's hit 60 and I'm afraid we're going to go and have an operation in 2 days' time. So I was more concerned about the cyst because she said, I don't want it to burst. And no thoughts about menopause at all. Next day, she said, oh, you've done well. You look good, because I had a lot of saline drips and I felt good. And then she said, how are you feeling otherwise? And I said, no, I'm all right. And then I thought about it. She said she'd taken out all my ovaries, and particularly the fallopian tubes because of cancer and stuff. And I'm like, okay, what does that mean? She goes, oh, you'll be fine. You know, just rest a bit. And, okay. So I thought about it. And I thought, ovaries gone. Okay, mostly, well, that means I'm definitely not having a kid. And so no thoughts on menopause. Yeah. And then I sent a message because I felt like I had been beaten up. Like I felt like I'd been punched up or something, like 48 hours later. And I was going, what did she do to me? You know, I was like, my left arm was aching and things were starting to ache. So I send my naturopath a note saying, by the way, over the weekend, this happened to me, you know. And then she said, right, you've gone into menopause. And I'm what? And basically, within that week and the weeks after, I couldn't open a door. I couldn't open bottles. I just started not being able to, like, I was arthritic, you know. And I was so, had she not said it will pass, I mean, you know, the moment will come and go, I would have freaked out. Because it was like, what's going on with me? Because I feel like my fingers were cramping. Mm. You know, and at the time, you know, I couldn't shake hands.
So this joint ache that you were talking about, was that the only symptom that you felt? But it obviously came on very quickly and very strongly.
That was the most pronounced one. It was the joint aches. I mean, it still happens today. I just go, this will pass. Yeah. You know, and it comes and I just go, okay. Which has made me go and design my future homes with door handles that I can do this to, taps I can do, all sorts of things, you know. You think about it. And my friends look at me going, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm future-proofing. Oh, I'm already in it. I'm planning that. But you've got to think about that. No, I think the most pronounced was that. But then, you know, you're the craziness and everything. Sure. That's it. That's in there.
That's in there too.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Relia, I mean, how does the experience of menopause differ for women who've had hysterectomies?
Hysterectomy is just removing the uterus. So if that happens, like Narian had a bit of ovary left, so you only need your ovaries, which make estrogen, to stop you going into menopause. But when you actually have the ovaries removed, then that's called a surgical menopause. Mm. And we know that it's a particularly, I'm just going to use the word vicious, but a particularly dramatic drop. So you're going from the top, no zigzag line, straight into zero. And it's a particularly symptomatic menopause. So that can happen with surgery or sometimes if you have chemotherapy, which can cut out your ovaries as well. And the joint aches and muscle pains is a really common symptom of menopause that people don't always pick up.
Well, all the symptoms we've been talking about so far were also true for Lucy. But then she had so much more as well. Now, you're doing well now, Lucy, which is great. But take us back to May, June last year. What was life like for you then?
It was really, really bad. I have been suffering from endometriosis for a long, long time. And I had previously had surgeries for it when I was 25 and when I was about 41. As well as endometriosis, I also had polyps and fibroids removed. And at that point, I was given an ablation of my uterus and I was told, oh, you won't bleed again for 2 to 5 years. I went, woohoo! A few months later, heavy bleeding again. And then from June last year, I had very, very heavy bleeding continuously, gushing.
When you're talking continuously?
Every day. Through my clothes. Through my sheets. Every day. As well as all of the perimenopausal symptoms, including the obscure ones.
Like what?
Oh, the ants on the skin sensation, cold hands and feet.
When you went to the doctor because you knew things weren't good, what were you told?
Where to begin? Okay, so I was told that I was highly unusual and irregular in all kinds of ways, which I already knew that. And on one particular occasion that I shared with you earlier, that a doctor sent me off for blood tests, and certainly it was helpful, Dr. Elliott, with your description earlier that the hormonal levels at the time aren't necessarily indicative of what's happening and you need to treat the symptoms, not the hormonal levels. She didn't know that. So the doctor proceeded to give me a prescription for something that I could buy off the shelf. So in my desperation, I presented that to the pharmacist and pointed me to an overpriced herbal supplement.
Did any of that help?
Of course not.
So you went back to a doctor again. What were you then told?
I was sent for more blood tests. I was sent for other tests because I had very unusual symptoms, including migraines, including nausea, including vomiting. So I do realise that my case was very, very unusual. And certainly too that fortunately I now have an extraordinary GP who actually identified that I also have a metabolic disorder called pyrrole disorder, which does tend to exhibit itself at particular hormonal junctions in your life.
How did you eventually get the right treatment?
I had a hysterectomy in April of this year, and that was fantastic in stopping the bleeding. When, as I left the hospital, that I was given estrogen gel, and I was told that I didn't need to have progesterone. I then got home and wasn't able to sleep, and the migraines came back. And when my amazing GP that I have now said, don't listen to them, here's some progesterone gel, life's been great.
All that stuff that you went through...
Yes.
You're feeling back to yourself again now, are you?
I feel fantastic now.
So this was like 9 months of...
Ten.
10 months.
Yeah. Not that
sorry,
I'm
I don't want to deny you any of those months. it was just 10 months of...
Hell.
Jane, do we know anything about what sort of women may experience more enhanced... or amplified symptoms?
Two things that certainly, if they're in the background, maybe we'll talk about mood disorders first because that's common. Each time the estrogen drops a little bit with periods, some of us get PMT. Some of us also get postnatal depression after a baby because the estrogen drops. So if I hear that someone has had any sort of mood problems in the past, particularly ones that are linked to hormonal changes, I would tell them ahead if I could. I'd say when we start zigzagging, you are going to be more vulnerable to that drop in estrogen because of what you've told me about postnatal depression or PMT. So that's something that's definitely any mood thing that's linked. And sometimes even just a past history of depression or anxiety can get worse once you start withdrawing hormones. Mm. So that's one thing. Your migraines are interesting because people who get migraines, particularly if they used to get them pre-period, they often go haywire at this time following that graph. And so migraine can get worse at this time. And people think you can't use hormones to treat migraine because you can't use the oral contraceptive pill to use with someone with migraine, but you can use HRT.
I heard Lucy's story, which went to several doctors. Are GPs equipped to spot the range of menopausal symptoms and how they might look in different women?
Well, I'm a GP, so in defence of GPs, it is hard to be a jack of all trades and good at everything. GPs are equipped if they're interested enough to educate themselves and if they give themselves and the patient enough time. This all takes a much longer than a 5 or 10 minute consult to draw out the symptoms and to discuss it all. That's really the thing. It can't be done with a quick blood test.
It's half the population, isn't it, women? Mm. It's an inevitable stage of life. You do wonder why not more is done proactively in the doctor's rooms to address it.
I think it's hugely under-doctored.
Well, I guess you can see here it's hard for women who are experiencing perimenopause to sometimes get the attention they need in the average age group, the group that we're expecting. What was it, 45 to 55, I think you said, was the average age of menopause. So imagine how much more difficult it must be if you enter menopause earlier than the average. Sonia, you're 36.
35.
Sorry, don't want to age you too much. You're 35 Sorry. Years old. How did you find out you're already in perimenopause?
I, based on my age, thought I better figure out what my child options are. I'm single, so what do I do? And I went to ReproMed, said, let's just figure out my timeline, can I freeze eggs, whatever it might be. And every other year that I've been doing my blood tests, we was always included an AMH test, and the levels were always normal. And this year in January, when we got those AMH results, they had plummeted to very, very little. I was concerned. I thought, let's get another opinion. And I went somewhere else, got a second blood test. By the time that that blood test had come up. It had gone down again. And so, yeah, I'm just running out of eggs. And it's I'll be lucky if I get one.
What was that like to hear?
It's very current, to be honest. I'm really glad that we're just lots of women here. Token man. Really glad there's lots of women here that I can share this with. But it was devastating. I was just kind of wrapping my head around that reality, let alone anything else that comes with that at my age. I mean, I'm single. And secondly, there's the whole cultural thing you've just talked about. I have no idea what any of this means. My mum and grandparents and everyone, it's not something you sit down and talk about. So I didn't feel comfortable to go and ask. I don't know what's going to be said. It's not a discussion point at all. So culturally as well, I'm in the dark. I'm young. Who do you talk to? None of your friends can relate. So to be honest, it's very current. I'm booked with my Repromed doctor next week to start harvesting if they're there. I'm terrified.
So you're in this window that's rapidly closing. You've made this decision to harvest your eggs. You're also single. So do you know whether your body can carry a child if you do get a successful egg and therefore an embryo?
No idea.
What sort of cultural barriers are there in discussing this with other women in your cultural group, with your mother, with your family? What sort of barriers are you facing?
A big one is that we never talk to men, which, can I just say, that's a problem. I feel for everyone back in my country where you never talk to men. Unfortunately, doctors are men in my country. So you can't talk to men about these things. It's taboo. And the doctors that you think you'd seek counsel from are men. Women do get together in their women groups, and you know, you'll find your grandmas and your mums getting together and probably sharing some stories, but that's amongst the older generation that are going through it at that time. When I mentioned my AMH levels to my mum, and I said, I'm going to have to go through IVF, just see what I can do, and then I just mentioned perimenopause, and she's like, oh, you're too young for that.
Jacqueline, you're listening to what Sonia has to say there. What has been your experience? Because you've worked as a community nurse in a lot of different cultural groups. Yeah. Is that common, these kinds of barriers?
I think depends on the education of the women and the country they're coming. Our Latin American women, the education is much better because we have the opportunities to go to school. Yeah, we not coming from war-worn countries like Afghanistan, our women are oppressed. But still, we have that, what you were talking about, where conversations of menopause or any sexual reproductive health is within kind of friends. We can talk with friends, but we don't talk about it very openly.
Let's talk about some treatments. How do you determine what's right for you? And can all women have replacement therapy?
Not quite, but the majority of healthy women can use MHT, and it is the best treatment. It's the gold standard. If women either have a uterus still or endometriosis in the past, we always add a second hormone, progesterone, but that's only to stop the estrogen causing changes in the uterus. That's the only use for the progesterone. So that's MHT, and for the majority of healthy women around the age of menopause, they can use MHT. But not all women want to use any treatment, in fact. Some women don't want to use MHT even if they can. The problem is that most of the over-the-counter herbal-type treatments, we've now got very good studies to show that, I'm afraid, they don't work. But there are things called non-hormonal treatments, which are drugs that need to be prescribed that are used for other reasons, completely other reasons, but happen to also help with some symptoms of menopause, like hot flushes, mood and sleep. So some of the newer antidepressants, got to get your head around using that for the hot flushes. And funnily enough, an epilepsy drug called gabapentin, which we use, nothing to do with epilepsy, you don't have to have epilepsy, we use it in what's called an off-label way, but it's quite good at helping with hot flushes, sleep. doesn't help formication, doesn't help the old lady feeling, doesn't help the vaginal symptoms. Estrogen's the only umbrella symptom, treatment.
Okay, and how long do you need to be on it? I mean, do you need to be on it during the squiggly time and then stop once you get to zero? Do you need to be on it for the rest of your life? How long?
You need to. There used to be rules about how long, and the new rules are that you can use it for as long as you need to for your symptoms. And if I've said that the majority of women have about, if they are getting symptoms at all, have them for about 8 years, often it is somewhere, but that means some women it's less than that, some women it's 3 to 4 years, some women 8 years, but 20% of women are still having significant troubles, and I'm still seeing them in their 70s and 80s. Oh. Basically, menopause never goes away. So we have to continue to make risk benefits assessments for those women to help them work out whether it is still worth using that for them.
I do want to talk about sex briefly. I mean, Marianne, you explained that one of the symptoms was very painful sex when this happened. I don't think you're alone in that. I think there are many of us that can put up their hand with that. And not all women are interested in an active sexual life after menopause, but for those who are, does that change and what can we do about it?
The changes in the vaginal area and the vulval area and the urethra, which is the opening of the bladder which goes into the vulva, are all sensitive to estrogen and lack of estrogen. And symptoms down there tend to happen a few years after the last menstrual period. Most people don't get so much of the dry vagina in the zigzag line. It's just often women will come and say, look, I did menopause, all right, the flushes weren't too bad, but gosh, this is really bad now. And unlike hot flushes, which in the majority of women eventually will go away with or without treatment, if a woman is getting symptoms in the vagina or the vulval area, there are two things about it. It will never go away and it will get worse with time. So it is important to treat that area. And once again, it is estrogen that the area is missing, and that is the best treatment. And it's very safe to use what's called topical, which just means in the vagina treatment. There are little pessaries or creams, and they have no implications for anywhere else. They do not increase your risk of breast cancer or clotting. You can use it at any age, and you can start it at any age. So I think it's really important. It's dead easy to treat. It makes a big difference to that area. But lots of doctors, unfortunately, don't even ask. And lots of women, obviously, are too embarrassed to ask.
Is vaginal dryness an issue for anything other than sexual reasons? Like, is it important to keep your vagina lubricated for something other than that?
Not lubricated, but for a lot of women, if the vagina gets too dry, it basically gets sore and irritated. And because of that entrance to the bladder being part of that, two things can happen. You can get that feeling like you just want to do a wee all the time, but then there's nothing there. And if that's happening, it can wake you up through the night. And also, it can lead to recurrent urinary tract infections. Mm. And one of the commonest, the best treatment for recurrent urinary tract infections, not for the acute phase, but is to use vaginal estrogen. This is in someone who's not sexually active necessarily.
Marion, I just wanted to ask you, though, before we move on, how did you come to be worried about bone density at the time of your menopause?
Actually, I was just 50, so only a couple of years later, my mum fell over and broke a bone, and I said to her, you need to have a bone density scan. I said to mum, look, if I come, will you? Mum wasn't too bad at all, and I had the bones of an 80-year-old. Now, let me tell you this. I had a bone density scan quite recently, and I've just snuck into the bones of an 80-year-old. And it's not because I've gained bone density. It's because I haven't lost it. That's the only reason. And in the meantime, back then, I don't know about now, back then, you couldn't take bisphosphonates unless you had broken a bone. And in 1996, I managed to break a toe, and for the next 5 years, I took bisphosphonates. I believe that we should have bone densitometry at menopause, not at the moment. You can have free bone densitometry at the age of 70. But I think every woman, and I'm sure Jane will back me up on this, should have bone densitometry to get a baseline at menopause.
As well as being a specialist GP in women's health, She's also on Healthy Bones Australia board, so I think she's got a lot to add to this. Osteoporosis and bone density, what's the relationship with menopause?
Peak bone density is built up by the time we're 20, and it just stays like that unless we've got some significant disease process. So when you're about 70 here, which is when the government lets you have a bone density, for some women, for everybody, they've lost bone. But it's a question of whether you're someone who's in the high zone up here or you're here. And if you're here and you're way down here, you've already lost most of the bone. So I do try as part of the menopause workup to get a bone density done at 50, not waiting till you're at the bottom of the slippery dip, because it actually helps in decision making. If I've got a lady who's got some hot flushes, she's not sure if she wants HRT, which is fine, and I find her bones are all right, we'll press on with just some calcium and vitamin D. But if I find she's way down, like Marion here, then if we don't stop that drop with the hook, because the HRT completely stops the drop of bone density, then she's got an added reason to consider using some hormones when she wasn't quite decided. And once we use the hormones, it flatlines the bone density again.
What treatment that is estrogen helps to stop weight gain, someone is asking?
Weight gain, yes. Every single patient I see, whether they're a very little lady or an ordinary lady or a very big lady, everybody complains of weight gain at menopause. So the sad thing is, I hate to tell you, but between 50 and 60, everybody gains weight. In big epidemiological trials, it's about a 5 kilo weight gain. And the thing we don't like as much as weight gain is shape change. So the weight is on the tummy. And so we change from a pear shape to an apple. And we certainly don't like the shape change, but the sad thing is that this tummy fat is diabetes fat and contributes to heart disease. So this, when women go on HRT, I always make sure they understand that HRT does not cause weight gain. But women on HRT also put on weight. In big trials, they tend to put on a bit less than the women not on HRT and less abdominal fat, which is how HRT helps to prevent diabetes. So everyone does it. And I think it is a time of life when you do have to focus more on exercise and eating healthily, not eating weird diets.
How do you find a good GP who specialises in women's health? Is there a place for recommendations or suggestions?
Yes, on one of those AMS infographics. Those infographics we've given you are very basic. I only wanted those handed out so you had the website to go to. There's much more detailed pamphlets. On the AMS website, there's a Find a Doctor Near Me. So for all over Australia, there's a Find a GP or a specialist near me who is interested in menopause. So you can look people up there.
I want to say a really big thank you to all our guests tonight, to Lucy, to Marion, Genevieve, Jacqueline and Sonia, and a really big thank you to Dr. Jane Elliott, who I think has been a marvellous